Hello.
Hello.
How's it going?
Okay. How you doing?
Very tired.
I'm tired, but not very tired. Medium tired. This is interesting.
I was going to do a Fight Club related like thing, but I couldn't think of anything because I'm too tired.
Well, the first rule a Fight Club is that you don't talk about Fight Club. So the podcast is over, and yeah. Thank you everyone for tuning in, and check back again in the near future for a new exciting episode.
I'm going to revoke our memberships to the Fight Club because we're breaking the rules.
Oh no, I can't have blood in my mouth. Shucks.
The HOA is gonna fine us for our conversation.
Yeah. Okay, so let's just dive right in and get this over with as quickly as possible because
what are we getting over with?
The movie.
I thought we were doing another preamble about Fight Club.
Oh, I mean that was gonna be part of my masterpiece that I've worked out so thoroughly.
You've woven a tapestry of narrator notes and things that you want to start with.
So Dan, Exhibit A. The film came out when I was in college, and the people that I was with in college, and I, to some extent, all thought that this was a very cool movie for very cool people, and that there were cool things in it that should be quoted and emulated.
I think everyone thought that. I don't know that.
Yeah.
At least I was in high school, not college, because it was 1999. Are you sure you were in college in 1999?
I know, but in college, the DVD release was a big deal.
Okay, that makes sense. I don't know anybody that got the movie when they saw it. But then again, why would I know anybody that got the movie when I was a teenager, if you know what I mean?
Yeah, well, I also don't know if anybody who got the movie really got the movie, because I don't know if I told you this story, but when my freshman year at Ringling, which is an art school, our RA was this kind of dweeby, like Edward Norton looking guy, but with a more receding hairline situation. And he decided that there were things about Tyler Durden that he would like to emulate in his personal life. So he had a red leather jacket.
Who didn't?
And the red sunglasses. And he would wear them sometimes when he was walking around. And he would try to be real cool around the ladies. If you know what I'm saying. And by that, I mean, he
was a dick and a weirdo.
He just seems so weird. But he didn't perceive that he was being weird because he thought he was emulating, you know, what Brad Pitt was in this film, which is not the same thing as what, you know, a human being might want to do in those situations.
He mixed up all the reception to all the great shape that Brad Pitt got into and was commented on at the time as, you know, oh, people like the way he looks in the movie. I should be like him in the movie. They missed the disconnect between the actor and the character there.
Yeah, and I had other friends in this crappy art school. Well, it's not crappy, but other friends in this art school who also felt similarly. You know, spiked hair would do. You know, say all of the things that Tyler Durden says. Mm-hmm. No one went so far as to start a Fight Club, thank God. But. Apparently that was like an epidemic of like people starting fight clubs in different places and actually suffering from injuries because they couldn't understand that this was not an instruction manual, that this was a film, and that Tyler Durden is not a positive force in the world that you should try to emulate.
I will say I fought some of my friends at this time, not necessarily because of Fight Club. I think it was more alcohol-based, but the timing is coincidental.
Like physically fought?
Yeah, no punching in the face or anything, but yeah, we used to fight each other. It was more of like the Jackass style of Fight Club, though, because, you know, similar time period as well.
Yeah, I was not a Jackass fan myself.
Well, so you missed that bus there.
Yeah, Shucks.
You're just in time. You know, the new one's coming out in February. Yeah. You can hop on the bandwagon now.
Just watch the retirees beat the crap out of each other. No, thank you. That does seem especially sad. I saw an advertisement for it the other day, and just to see Johnny Knoxville, is that his name? Johnny Knoxville? Yeah, with the gray hair, beating the crap out of Steve-O, who just looks like an animated skeleton, is just not
the
enticing.
Funniest part about that is apparently he's had gray hair forever, but he used to dye it for the movies and shows because they told him to. So that's just all the funnier.
Yeah, I read the, I forget where.
Oh, right. It was not like a Vanity Fair article or something.
Yeah, it was like Vanity Fair, I want to say, where he had talked about, you know, just because of COVID, he just stopped doing it because what was the point? And then he just had gray hair. So, you know.
I was looking up the DVD release date, by the way, June 6, 2000. I have the two disc collector's edition DVD as well. It has like the little like paper. It looks like wrapped in brown paper with a piece of twine tied around it. I don't know if that's the DVD version you had as well.
No, I don't own it. I never owned it. But yeah, in fact, for discussing this movie, I had to rent it because I thought it was for free. However, what I came to realize is that it is not for free. It is for free on IMDb TV, which now shows up inside of Amazon Prime's video app. So when you open up, or if you use a Siri voice search and you say Fight Club, it'll show you that you can watch it on Prime Video. And then you click on it and you're like, fine, I'll watch it on Prime Video. It'll be great. I'll have to watch, you know, an ad for the new season of Mrs. Maisel in front of it, but then all of a sudden it'll just play. And no, the whole situation with IMDb TV is that it's like if you could have like Real Player on your television.
That's great.
Quality was so awful. I just immediately bailed. I couldn't even make it through the opening credits. I just went and grabbed the rental. Not that this is like a visually sumptuous, you know, film, but just
sure it is. The cinematography is great.
Yeah, but like it's not so gorgeous that my mind couldn't have filled in the blanks. I just didn't want to look at the artifacting lines through everything from like the compression blocks, because the whole movie is so gritty in every aspect of it that it doesn't compress well.
So there's a new series of Marvelous Mrs. Maisel coming out. Is that what I gather here?
No, I was just making a joke about how Amazon.
I like that show though.
Yeah, well, that's fine. I'm not making fun of the show. I'm just saying Amazon likes to have a little like teaser of something else to watch ahead of anything you watch on their service.
Yeah,
yeah.
Well, unsurprisingly, I own this. I don't know when or how or why I bought it on digital, but I have it. And I actually, I was beginning to feel a little bit bad about my purchase of my large AirPods, but I used them in conjunction with my Apple TV to watch the movie with the big headphones. It was quite nice. I enjoyed that a lot, probably because it partially, you know, tamps down my ADD temptation to like stare at my phone the entire time when I'm watching a movie that I've already seen. It helped me focus because it was very loud and in my ears. But it was nice to get the cinematic experience of watching the movie with the big fancy headphones on.
That's good.
I enjoyed the movie is what I was saying. You know, one of the hardest things about this movie, especially, I don't know how we communicate this to the audience if you weren't there, but the thing you were describing earlier, the phenomenon of people not getting Fight Club back when Fight Club was new, you can't over express how much people did not get the movie. Not just like, oh, it was, you know, critically panned or whatever because people didn't understand what the filmmaker was saying. Like, no. We got the exact opposite message for years and years and years. So the attempt yesterday to watch the movie with fresh eyes is startlingly difficult. And I spent most of the time trying to figure out what I actually thought of the movie and how is it possible to watch this movie with fresh eyes now. It's not quite as bad as like Ghostbusters 2016, as we talked about, but it's got a thing. It's got a thing where you're like, man, I remember youth. I remember being stupid. I remember how all of these things made me feel when I was a teenager and how all of those feelings were wrong. But if you try to watch it as a movie, you know, similar to, I mean, it's the whole point of the movie. It's seductive, and it made me realize a little bit about what I like about David Fincher as a director is that It's his precision and his just attention to detail. It really helps you suspend your disbelief so quickly that you're like, oh, okay, this is a little weird. You got this guy here who's who hasn't slept in months, and he's a little quirky, works a boring job or whatever, and he does this thing where he's going to you know, support groups or whatever, which is kind of messed up but a little weird, and like whatever he's got to do to like feel better about himself. But the way you sort of trip and fall down this rabbit hole of like, oh, now he's got this weird friend who's even weirder than him, and now they're doing this, and you suspend your disbelief so quickly and easily that you find yourself halfway through Fight Club, the act of the fighting in the club, right before Project Mayhem, and you're like, I should be questioning more of these things, but this movie has made me not step back and go, what is happening and why is this happening? This doesn't make any sense, because you just accept so much of it as like being a movie and being sucked into it that, and again, this is me probably because I'm super easy at suspending disbelief when I watch a movie that I really like. But the movie really draws you in and holds your attention to the point where you're like, you're damn near into, you know, beating up a priest on the sidewalk before you go, wait a minute, this is not how normal people act.
Well, I had those.
It's probably earlier in the movie for you where you're like, there's something a bit amiss about these characters here.
Yeah.
They're fighting each other in the back of, this disgusting tavern here.
Yeah, I think it is easier to buy into the narrative of the movie while you're watching it when you have the narrator telling you what to think or feel about the situation, which is a choice that's in the screenplay adaptation of this and also in the directing of this, and the way that Edward Norton talks, I guess. But it gives you just kind of casual, this is how things are, this is how things are going, this is the thing that's going on.
It's a narrative device that kind of like sneaks in the side door of like, they're very like the opening line of the movie when he's talking about the detonation, you know, it's what, 20 seconds in where he says, I know this because Tyler knows this. Like there should be a moment in there where you're like, hang on, what did you just say? But because we're used to narration and stuff where you're like, oh, you're just going to give me some information, that you just kind of, you let a lot of it go along.
Yeah. Go on to that point you had just for a second, just for a tangent. That's one of the things I think that also is appealing about this to people with DVD players in the early 2000s is because it has rewatchability. It is very easy to watch this movie and then want to watch it again to understand the reveal that occurs. And if you are someone who is listening to this podcast who has for some reason not watched Fight Club or doesn't understand what twist is, let me just say that we're gonna talk about it right now. Dan yeah. said as much as what the movie says at the beginning, but Edward Norton's unnamed narrator character, who apparently goes by Jack in the screenplay, is Tyler Durden, who is the Brad Pitt character, and that it is a weird multiple personality disorder situation, kind of. They don't name specifically what's going on there mentally, but it is a construct inside of Brad Pitt is a construct inside of Edward Norton's mind that has some sort of control and ability to manifest in the actions of Edward Norton without his knowledge or consent, but also simultaneously can be there during some events, and Edward Norton can feel like he is participating or watching in something that someone else is doing, having an out-of-body experience where he sees this other person. But it's all that part of it where you see that it's not, the movie doesn't really trick you. It just doesn't tell you specifically until a certain point in the production
because
of the film.
It's not necessarily the point of the plot for most of the movie. Like there's a lot of interesting stuff happening that you're following along with where you don't really spend a lot of time wanting to question this relationship most of the way through. You're just like, what are these crazy dudes doing?
Yeah. And you know, I don't find the reveal to be out of nowhere or weird or anything. And I feel like, you know, especially when you're rewatching it, it does reward you to see the ways in which they chose to weave in the existence of Tyler Durden. Mm-hmm. And how they choose to do it in a like meta contextual way as well, because one of the things about Tyler Durden is that he splices in pornography into in between reels as they change over in reels of film, and mm-hmm. that was something projectionists could, you know, do, I guess, at a certain era in the past. So kids these days don't understand that you could apparently have your talking animated movie with celebrity voices, and then there would be a penis. But the that is what leads to Tyler Durden appearing in like single frame flashes mm-hmm. in the earlier parts of the film, and you don't know that he is there because you don't know who Tyler Durden is. When you rewatch the film, you see Tyler Durden, and it's like almost like a, you know, a ghost where it's like building to something.
Mm-hmm. And this yeah. it was all part of the marketing at the time too. Everyone was like, oh, there's seven flashes of Brad Pitt, did you catch them all? And like, you know, even the soundtrack was a huge thing at the time too, especially for
Dust Brothers.
Nerds who like techno-y type music, which was a thing at the time. The soundtrack was incredibly popular, and there was like, oh, one of his character does some singing on one of the songs or something. Like there was so much marketing around the movie that, like, if you wanted to go deep on this movie at the time, there was a lot of Easter eggs and stuff that you could find fascinating. And, you know, again, even with the rewatchability, because of course the DVD, very rewatchable, a lot of special features, if I recall. I kind of wish that two disc DVD thing that I bought wasn't a terrible SD DVD, because I do remember there being a lot of interesting stuff on there.
Well, they do, like, they have re-released, like, I'm sure there's like a 4K, like super duper duper version that's
I'm not going to go buy any optical media. I don't even have any disc players connected to my TV anymore. Mm-hmm. But it's weird though, with all of the rewatching and all of the, like, oh, you know, I rewatched and I could see where they crossed over and he said that thing here and then he did that there. Even in all of the rewatching, you get all of the, like, he's the same guy, I can see them leading up to it. The thing that we still continued to miss the entire time was, like, the unreliable narrator and the depth of his mental illness, and how that was, like, he was playing off of himself and, you know, trying to come to terms with who he wanted to be, who he thought he wanted to be, you know, his secondary personality just going too far and his original personality, like, recognizing that he was going off the deep end, but unable to control, like, all of those psychological dynamics that are probably more interesting to adults than they were to teenagers at the time. You go like, oh man, it's the same guy. But like, he's not just the chaotic, like, antagonist in the story. Like he's a split personality that is causing real, both like physical harm to the world and mental harm to this human being. And it's just like, we missed all of that stuff back then because it was just too much fun to dress funny, pretend you were Brad Pitt, punch people and blow stuff up.
Yeah, and you say things like, you were not the things you own, the things you own you, or whatever. And
oh, everyone was so clever.
I mean, but you, I don't know if you feel this way. I felt this way when I was rewatching it. I hadn't seen this movie in a very long time. And while I know the stuff in the film, like, I didn't forget it or anything, just seeing it play out and seeing Brad Pitt say certain things, the way he, like, leans in the shot and does, you know, like, his whole, like, I'm a dude's dude saying all this stuff, and then he, like, blurts out something and you're just like, wow, that could just as easily be from Joe Rogan or from Alex Jones, or like it just
the one,
like,
that got me was we're a generation of men raised by women. I'm wondering if a woman is really the answer we need, and you're like, hang on a sec, what did you just say?
It's such a stupid thing to say, because
is Fight Club the He-Man Woman Haters Club? Is that what's going on here? Is this the Little Rascals, but like with gore?
Yeah, well, we didn't have the term incel in the early 2000s, but that's basically what's going on. Is just like,
well, he's not an incel. He has a girlfriend.
I don't know.
Strange girlfriend.
so I guess he's not an incel, but he's like red pilled, which is a different 2000s movie. But yeah. it's a thing where he is someone who feels like he has this threatened masculinity. So he has made this other version of himself that is hyper masculine in a weird way. Not that any version of a hyper masculine person is like in a normal way, I guess, but
no, like it would be better if more people just like daydreamed these, terrible hyper masculine people instead of actually becoming them.
Yeah. Just as like to further drive home the weirdness of that one particular line is he says, you know, we're a generation of men raised by women. I'm really wondering if another woman is what we need. He says it while he's in the bathtub scrubbing his like dirt and wounds and stuff while Edward Norton is sitting there in the bathroom with him just on the floor. And it's just like, what? Is this like a manly thing? Because I don't associate any of this with manliness, but it is that sort of like strange, like locker room vibe of manliness, mm-hmm. which is permeates the rest of the film in terms of like the fighting scenes and the like negging people to be inducted into their frat house, where they have bunk beds in the basement and they brainwash people and shave their heads. Like it is a whole. Like a really toxic thing to take seriously if you were someone who's so inclined to take it seriously. And I don't think the movie does enough to show that it is not asking you to do these things.
You're right. I mean, I think the reason it does that is on purpose. Like it, but again, like the level of polish of this movie and the way it is so well crafted, like, you know, you start out with like, who's this crazy weird guy who's different than me and, you know, seems like he's got it all together. And just like it slip slides so fast into this world, this like absolute toxic, crazy world where they're blowing stuff up and just running around in ski masks, blowing things up. Mm-hmm. But it's that, you know. When you're young and you make when you're like, you meet like a kid who's a couple years older, and you're like, this guy's cool. He's got it all together. We're friends now. And you don't realize that he is absolutely the most toxic friend you could ever possibly have and is a terrible influence until it's way too late. But it's like, it's so seductive to think that this guy's got this like totally contrarian worldview and he's got all the answers. He's got an answer for every single thing that you've been frustrated against and he's got the answer for it and look how free he is. And then you're in so deep before you go, oh no, this is all very wrong. This guy he's a contrarian, but he's the exact opposite of rational and normal, and we should be running from this man as fast as we can, not using him as some sort of idyllic figure for how we to build like a pseudo religion around, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's probably the thing I find more repellent about it as an adult watching this is because I can, and I don't know if it's just because I'm an adult or because I'm an adult who's also been through like the last 20 years of crap that's existed in the world, but it doesn't seem seductive to me. And I know what you're saying when you say seductive, like it is inviting you to consider the appeal. The movie is inviting you to consider the appeal of these things that are appealing to the character in the film, to the narrator, to Edward Norton's,
you know,
character.
If you throw away all of your worldly possessions, it's only after you've lost everything that you're free to do anything. Imagine if it was as simple as throwing away all your stuff, leaving your house, just like wandering the streets, and you could be free. You could feel free all the time. These people who day to day feel constrained by a job or friends or family or whatever. Imagine if there was an answer where you could feel free again. And like this guy appears to be living that and is offering that to you. That's the seductive thing I'm talking about.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is it is not seductive if you understand that you don't want to lose everything, that you want to have your stuff, that these are kind of empty promises. Right. If you lose everything, you'll be free. It's like you're not.
It doesn't hurt that our narrator didn't have a whole lot of valuable stuff.
No, our narrator
had a dead-end job and some IKEA furniture.
Yeah, I mean, what a great loss. But he's this is, you know, kind of the flaws that you run into when you have a sort of bizarrely fascist terrorist organization that springs up with like, you know, libertarian philosophies and stuff, is like you have some guy who thinks, oh yeah, we'll be free once we get rid of all this crap, and once we like threaten our lives, then we'll like feel alive. And it's like, yeah, I guess, but do you want to follow that through a little? Because Bob died.
It's 'cause people don't think that through, that, you know, you've got this blank slate of a human being. And, you know, again, this is why I guess they referred to it as sort of a coming of age movie in a different sense. But this guy's like, you know, I've been doing all this stuff people told me to do, and it doesn't seem to really get me anywhere. And I don't know, this guy seems like he knows what he's talking about, so let's try that out now. Like, you know, it makes as much sense as anything else I've heard. But yeah, he doesn't immediately say, now if I listen to what this guy's saying and take it to its logical conclusion, where does that lead? Does it lead to the destruction of all of the skyscrapers and banks in my town? I probably wouldn't imagine, but I'm just going to go have a beer with this weird dude and, you know, maybe punch some people in a parking lot. Spirals into, you know, threatening the governor, the head of the police department with a knife, trying to, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the destruction of all the credit card companies. But
great plan, by the way.
It is.
Before the internet.
Yeah. It's kind of stupid afterwards. But it is also, I think, a situation that winds up with, I think, people who are fans of the film, who love, you know, like or love the film, tend to remember the beginning of the film up through the start of Project Mayhem, and then remember the very end with the Pixie song playing. And they don't really remember Project Mayhem is bad, and that is... You know, there's some bad stuff in there, like when they assault the convenience store clerk in order to motivate him to go back to school.
Mm-hmm.
But then they if they're going to destroy society, why are you torturing this person into going back to a school? Like, I don't understand.
To open his eyes, man.
It doesn't make any sense. No, but
and then there's, you know, LOL, look at all the bird poop on the BMWs. Like, you know, here's a VW bug. We're going to make the airbag go off with some baseball bats.
Yeah, and all these rich people, they get their facts sucked out, and we're going to turn into soap and sell it back to the rich people. Ah, we really stuck it to them. It's just like, it's the kind of, like, not deep thoughts that someone has when they're at
It's a teenage mentality of an undeveloped mind who is, you know, lost and seeking guidance, and he rather than finding a, you know, early 20s toxic friendship with somebody else who appears to have their stuff more together, who actually doesn't, he just makes up his own friend.
Well, he's supposed to be in his 30s in this. And
he's a 30-year-old boy. Yes, of course.
Yeah. And so that's one of the things I think that makes it a little different. Although, you know, like I said, the fans of this were in their late teens and early 20s.
So the relationship he has with his imaginary friend is kind of the sort of thing that somebody in their early 20s would do, is I guess the point I was making.
Yeah. But it is one of those things where you think about it, and I would compare it to American Psycho, which is also another movie that came out around the same time and had a sort of similar issue where there are people who unironically like certain parts of American Psycho in a way that is not healthy. And there are people who unironically like parts of Fight Club that is not healthy, that they don't understand that those are sort of like I don't want to say, like, this movie's not like a dark comedy so much. It's definitely a drama, but there are satirical moments in here where they're saying, like, don't literally do this. But in American Psycho, I feel like it's a little more overt that he's awful than it is here. Because in this version, you have a narrator who doesn't seem awful, who seems more like the audience, which is why I think that it has a certain appeal for the audience member. Whereas in American Psycho, the main character is not like the audience.
Yes, and he's doing lots of very weird,
gruesome
murdering
murders.
People with a straight face. Yeah. You know, the problem, I think, in terms of what you were saying about the movie not going far enough to say don't actually do these things, or like this is a joke or something, or like Tyler Durden is bad, is at the end of the movie, you know, we as the audience, we are we are tied to our narrator, and the whole, you know, this is too much, I don't want this, like that stuff. It feels like one character versus another, and it feels like he's saying, this is too much for me, I don't want this, I want a more normal life. Like, thanks or whatever for opening my eyes, but this is crazy, and like, I want to go a different way. In the way it's presented, it doesn't overtly say, this is too much, you are insane, and this is over the line. It sounds more like a personal, like, you know, you go your own way, I'm going to go mine. Like, this is not for me. And it's not saying, this is bad for the world, stop it.
Well, he says it's bad for the world, but I don't think this is primary concern. His primary concern is Marla.
But well, it's also regaining control of his life, because, you know, like, as he reveals later on, like, you know, Tyler grows in strength. Like, the more he admires Tyler, the Tyler grows in strength, to the point that, like, Tyler continues to grow and he no longer has any control over it. It becomes the dominant personality. And he's kind of like, hey, can I have some control back? Because I no longer like just quite how nuts some of the stuff is that we're doing. I don't like being along for this very dangerous ride. I would like to be the one in control again. I would like to be the 51% of the Senate over here making the decisions. But you know, ultimately he has to, you know, kill that other personality in order to like regain that control. But it's not like, hey,
yeah, well, he wouldn't have to kill that person if part of his brain just didn't deeply believe that you should have a 60 vote minimum in order to move anything through the Senate.
You know, really, if it weren't for the filibuster that he pulls out there at the end, he would have lost.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So anyway, sorry,
it was bad. It was bad.
Your metaphor was interesting. I don't know, but I wonder if that's an issue of how the movie is structured, or how the stylistic trappings of it can have more allure in like certain parts of it.
The more you play it as subtext, the more that like it has a story, but with, you know, ooh, there's an underlying message. It's not trying to hit the audience over the head with anything. You actually have to think about it to understand what it's saying. And nobody thought about it at the time, because they're like, that movie was crazy, man. Did you see all the stuff?
Yeah. Well, I mean, people did think about it, but they were the movie critics who panned it. I don't know. I'm not with the movie critics on this one, because I don't reject this movie as vociferously. However, I'm trying to find the positive things about this movie existing in the world, and I'm coming up a little short.
Because, well, okay, so yeah. If I understand what you're saying, and I think I agree with you, this movie is incredibly well made. Mm-hmm. It did exactly what it was trying to do, but maybe we shouldn't have tried to do it in this way, is I think what you're saying, because it doesn't help people. It caused more harm than good, and maybe we should have seen that coming.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, oh, you've made a perfect movie that inspires people to, you know, injury and harm. And it's like, but is that good? Like, should you
I don't know that they made it with the intention of it having the impact on people that it did. I think he tried to make the most impactful version of the book story that he could. And I think he did, but
yeah, I know. But that's the thing. It's like, if art is communication and you're trying to communicate your ideas out to the world and have an effect on an audience, what is the effect you ideally want to have on the audience who is watching Fight Club? And is it the effect that Fight Club has had on its audience, where you have all of the news stories about people starting local Fight Club chapters and like beating the crap out of each other and having to go to hospitals and things?
Yeah, the narrative at the time, because I don't know if everyone remembers, but again, I still remember a lot of this stuff very vividly, was about, you know, this sort of bold statement about the rejection of consumerism and, you know,
How's that working out?
Yeah. Do you remember the website, by the way, the 1999 Fight Club website?
No. Is that on like Internet Archive?
Oh, I hope it is. It is extraordinarily Web 1.0, but there was
Space Jam?
I think better. There's a store where you could go buy Tyler Durden's clothing. But you would, like, you know, his t-shirt, like the tank top would be like $75. And you're like, Jesus. And you would add these things to your cart. And as soon as you click check out, it would say, congratulations, you're a consumer whore or whatever. Like, it'd give you this big message about, like, you failed the test. Congratulations. It's like, oh, interesting.
Yeah.
Okay. I feel bad now.
Well, that's interesting. I didn't know about that. I didn't ever try to visit the website at the time.
I didn't get it. I was just like, oh, it's doing a thing. It's wait, doing a show. It's doing art.
You didn't get it?
Well,
you were trying to buy a Tyler Durden shirt?
I understood it, but I was surprised. I was just playing around on the site. I was like, let's add this to a card.
And then I saw the message. Do you have a red leather jacket you want to tell me about?
I do not. Actually, I have an off-color brown jacket from the 70s that belonged to my dad that's a little Tyler Durden-esque, but not on purpose.
No, well, I mean, obviously, I only care about it being on purpose. It is.
I'm not saying I never put it on and thought, like, this is a little Tyler Durden of me right now, but I didn't leave the house with the intention of being a spiky-haired guy talking to people in strange parables and punching my friends.
Did you ever try to spike your hair?
My hair is not spikable.
To spike your hair?
No, my hair has never been spikable. Okay. I have put gel in my hair from time to time and gone like, nope, that's not a thing.
No. Hair product is tricky. But, you know.
I did do some unfortunate eyewear at the time, and I thought it was silly and quirky. But I'm not going to recount that here because it is almost too embarrassing to relay publicly. If you are aware of what I am referring to because you knew me in my teens, I apologize for the person that I was.
What color was the eyewear?
I can't.
What was the color of the lenses, Dan?
No.
You're not going to tell me?
Nope.
We've been through?
Not on air, no. Actually, you know what? Fine. Because I don't think the people that listen to this could have any lower opinion of me than I do of myself. I had a pair of broken Oakleys that I don't know where I found. They were that sort of like brownish tortoise shell color, but they were like the wraparound Oakleys. They weren't mine. They did not have lenses. They did not have the piece that goes over your ears. I secured them to my head with a 12-inch long rubber band.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I guess it was a trick question. There were no lenses.
Okay. Imagine a pair of Oakley frames with no sides, with one of those extraordinarily long green rubber bands going from side to side, and me wearing them like a pair of skiing goggles.
And how did your Brokleys go over with everybody else?
I don't really remember how often I wore them. Maybe twice. I didn't really wear I didn't put these on and go to school or anything. But this was a thing that that I put on my head from time to time.
Oh,
it might actually still be around here, like in a box somewhere. But I doubt it. I probably threw them away.
Well, you should definitely find them.
I did find a pair of the actual Oakleys that I had my freshman year of college. They're this sort of like I don't know, bluey purpley kind of see through color. They're very small. For the size of my head now, but they were nice back then.
Yeah. I mean, it was a style at the time to have like colored lenses that were not actually light blocking that people would wear like in the evening time.
No, I never did any of that.
Oh, people did. People did in Florida.
Part of me wants to become like a Robert Downey Jr. character now and just wear blue or yellow or red lenses everywhere I go and just be that guy.
I mean, You could.
Yeah.
Like you said, people can't think any less of you. So the world's your oyster.
That's true. At this point, I'm both old enough to know better and old enough to not care what other people think about me. So I'm just going to do whatever I'm going to do. Mm-hmm.
The things you own end up not mattering. So
TM just said, be that guy, Dan. Don't encourage me, TM.
Well, and I just, I don't know. I'm curious, though. Since you are, I think, a bigger Fincher fan than I am, by like every definition of it,
it's worth mentioning that when I first saw this movie, I didn't know who he was.
That's fine. I didn't know that either. But obviously, you've grown to be a Fincher fan, and you have been for many, many years, and you've enjoyed all of his films to varying degrees. So where do you slot in Fight Club with everything else? Because I honestly haven't seen all of David Fincher's films, so I don't know if I feel comfortable ranking this or putting this in with everything else to say that it is the one of the best or something along those lines. And I don't think I would say the best as my personal ranking, but I would say that it's definitely a more memorable David Fincher film than some of his other stuff in the 90s.
Well, thanks to Envy Ultra and my texts files here and the conversation that we had via iMessage with Todd many moons ago, I copy and pasted the list that I came up with last year or the year before when we had this conversation, because I don't ever want to try and re-rank these movies to see where I placed Fight Club. And I placed Fight Club at number two overall. Now, again, it's also worth mentioning that as much as I did enjoy immersing myself in watching this movie yesterday, I only watched half of it because I don't have time to watch the other half of it. So I kind of do want to watch the second half of the movie again with my headphones on with a little bit more attention to detail. But it's ranked number two behind The Social Network in terms of Fincher movies. But yeah, I mean, there's varying. I think the problem with this list is that the reason something is in a certain slot varies based on the movie.
Okay. Yeah, I would say that I can't remember from that conversation because I didn't save it in Envy Alt where I ranked Fincher films. But
I bet I can find it in the messages history if you want me to look right now.
Oh, sure. Go ahead. I don't know. I think I also had a different opinion of it at the time because I was going off of memory because I hadn't seen this in a long, long time. I think, obviously, The Social Network is a better, more, I don't know, filmy film for me than this. This is almost a kind of genre-defying, like, you know, I'm going to go for it. I'm going to, like, make something stylish and outlandish and meta about what filmmaking is.
Mm-hmm.
Because he does those things where it's just like, yeah, there's the cigarette burns and the cut in the splicing in of Tyler Durden in a few places, and also the, like, when Tyler's talking to the camera and I'm the all-seeing all that, and the film is going, like, out of register or whatever on the sides, and you see that, like, vibrating weirdness, and it's just sort of like, yeah, you're watching a movie. This is the conventions of movie making that are being exhibited as part of the film, as a stylistic choice of the film. And you have the stuff that is the late, very late 90s, early 2000s of, like, yeah, the camera can go anywhere and be anything and fly through any tiny, tiny little crevice that you want it to, which is, I feel like, something that I'm glad we've moved on from as a society.
You're going to love watching Panic Room, then.
Honestly, that's one of the reasons I never watched Panic Room. It was in the trailer and, like, promotional materials for it, and I was just like, ah,
yeah, they referred to it as the shot from the movie, this huge three-story techno crane shot that goes, you know, horizontally, then vertically, then horizontally again, unbroken, you know, through the teapot and whatever. Yeah. Yeah, I think that's the other thing about these movies. Like, when you're talking about genre defining, like it's, I don't want to give David Fincher too much credit because it is very easy for me to do so because I do like the things he does. But, like, you look at what he did here and you're like, he did each one of these pieces exactly the way it seems like he wanted to do them. And he did them so extremely well. You're like, is this director a genius? Like, he did all of these things perfect. Like, the audience didn't, like, missed it. The critics didn't like it. Eventually it was appreciated, maybe, probably, you know, wrongly. I mean, we all appreciated it wrongly, but, like, did he really see all of this stuff the way he made it and just, like, it came out exactly the way he intended it to? Because that is laudable, I guess, but, like, it's so hard to do, and that's what he did here, and then this is the thing that came out of it. You can't give him too much credit because there's too much serendipity in movies, but you look at this thing that here and you go, like, did he know he was making this thing when he made it? And, like, there's quotes from, I don't know, maybe it's from the behind the scenes of the DVD. No, it's from some other interview I heard that sticks with me. Like, there's lines from his interviews that always stick with me. But one was, you know, talking about this movie, he said, I laid it all out for him. I said, here's where we're going to feel a little violent. Here's where we're going to feel a little misogynistic. Like I explained the entire story to them and they were all like, yeah, yeah, let's do it. And it wasn't until they watched the movie where they all realized they were about to get fired.
Mm. Oh, you mean the movie executives?
The movie executives. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. That's him talking about the studio basically and saying like, mm-hmm. I explained it to him. This is what we were doing. And they were like, great, thumbs up, do it. And then I did it. And they were like, oh, no. Oh, no. But I did find your list, by the way, if you are curious.
Oh, I am. Tell me the things that I ranked.
Like me, you ranked The Social Network number one and Fight Club number two.
Mm. Oh, wow. That interesting.
Zodiac number three, Alien three, and then The Game. And then you said The Game sucks ass.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, and I think that's all the David Fincher films I've seen.
You did caveat it by saying you are not a Fincherphile.
Yeah, but it's the...
Oh, it's a good thing I read this. Todd's is not a public list, so I should not dox his Fincher list.
Oh, yeah, don't do that. This is the secrets that we keep.
The secrets.
But the... I don't know. I don't know how I feel about it, because, you know, one of the interesting things about Seven, which... oddly enough, was not on that list, but I've seen, is that no one was inspired to do Seven stuff. Like, that was, but, and, you know, you think about, like, Zodiac, and it's like, nobody was inspired by the film to do, like, Zodiac things.
Mm. Has anyone tried to Gone Girl their husband?
Not that I know of, but you look at Fight Club, and it's like, yeah, this inspired people to take it unironically and very seriously, as something that the appeal spoke directly to them, and the parts that say the appeal is not good, you know, that part is just kind of like vacant, absent from their recollections of things. And
everyone,
it's interesting,
just saw this normal, yeah, boring Edward Norton guy and Brad Pitt going, look at all you could have if you were just like me, and they're like, yes, lesson learned. Following that, you're like, no, keep watching, keep learning lessons as the movie goes on. They're like, nope, got it. Just be whatever guy I want to be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know. And so it's just like, do I, as someone who understands the film, can I just be like, well, I like it and I think it's okay, so I rank it highly, knowing that there are other people who are going to be like, yeah, man, you know, good stuff. Yeah.
You think there's still that subsection of our generation of incels or whatever, red-pilled people who, mm-hmm, still don't understand that, no, they are the asshole.
I would point you to the Joe Rogan Experience that's on Spotify.
No.
The enormous listenership that he has.
Right, but like, do you think they still look at Fight Club and go like, hell yeah, man, fighting is awesome?
I
guess that's everyone who watches UFC, Joe Rogan included, huh?
Yeah, I can 100% guarantee you that there are people out there who are still like, yeah, this is the best. And it's just like, no, you're not understanding the parts that you should understand. And you're just seeing like the glossy parts that are supposed to appeal to the character that Edward Norton is playing.
Mm-hmm.
And you're not understanding the rest of it, because there are people who feel emasculated and who feel numb to sensation and stuff, and so they understand the appeal of Tyler Durden to Edward Norton at the beginning of the film, but then, much like you, don't seem to have watched the latter half of the film or understand why there are some negative parts of that. And I'd be curious, like you said, if you go back and you watch the second half of this again, like, because I know you've seen it enough. I'm not going to like be like, oh, we need to cancel the podcast and do it over again so we could really fully understand it. No,
I could describe the end, mm-hmm, half of the movie to you in a lot of detail.
I'm sure you can. Yeah.
I could probably recite the scenes to you.
Yeah.
Not in order, but I know the words.
So it's not like a question of you knowing it. It's just like, I wonder if you sat there and watched it, if you'd have the same feelings knowing the information that's currently swimming in your head about the world we live in 2022. And almost said 2021 because, you know, I'm an idiot. But the
well, it's interestingly the place where I turned it off was exactly the moment where I think I noticed the switch flipping, where the movie tipped too far into, hang on a minute, this is not normal. It's when Lou beats him up and then he bleeds all over him and then he starts the homework assignments.
Yeah.
As soon as it cuts to the car dealership and you hear the circus music start playing, you're like, we're somewhere else now, aren't we?
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, all of this stuff that follows after this is going to start to seem like, oh, this is just fun silliness again, but things are growing and getting out of control in a very weird way. And then I know by the time you get into, you know, the jealousy against Jared Leto and, you know, that whole thing, that's yet another, it should have been a sign that, like, this is getting weird. And then the escalation of just almost beating him to death is like, okay, mm-hmm, where are we going now, guys?
Best character Jared Leto's ever played.
What is his character's name? It's
Angel, like, Face, I think.
Angel
is the
Face,
name.
That's, yeah, right. Yes.
Yeah, I, as we've established, don't care for him. But this was early on in his career. And oddly enough, he's in this and American Psycho. And I think, what were they, a year apart from each other? 2 years apart? But yeah, it's curious to see him cast in these roles. But he doesn't have a big thing here. So obviously, you know, he wasn't a star at the time. But the main issue, of course, of him being beaten up because he wanted to destroy something beautiful. Like, I've heard people say that, like, quote, when I was in college, but not, like, about anyone or targeted at anything, but in a way that made me concerned, that they didn't understand that that was bad, you know, and that it is not a laudable kind of desire to have. So just, you know, to circle back to, I don't know that everyone who sees this film, even beginning to end, like, really understands there are negative things in here.
Yeah, I agree, but, like,
yeah,
the things are here and the movie is still good. So, like, do we need to take this movie off the shelf because it's too good and people don't get it? Or do we just kind of shrug our shoulders and go, like, well, you know, tried a thing and it was too ahead of its time for the audience.
No, well, I don't actually think it's ahead of its time. I think it's kind of retrograde, but it's well done. The stylistic stuff about the movie is ahead of its time, but the, like, thoughts and feelings about it are not, you know, forward-thinking.
I wonder if, like, there are a lot of movies we watch now with our 2022 eyes and go, like, oh, yeah, this message that was subtle at the time is extremely not subtle now that we have slightly better tuned social antenna or something. I wonder if this is one of those movies that modern audiences would be able to watch and go, I see everything you're doing, and you're not as clever as you think you are. But I think the polish of it all and the gloss, STM called it, of the filmmaking still pulls you in a way that, like, you buy into this weird green dark world so fast that it's like, can people see past it now if they weren't around back then? Because I know I still have my residual teenage feelings watching this, but I do wonder if people now are sophisticated enough to go, like, yeah, this is all bullshit. Tyler Durden's toxic from the word go.
Yeah, I mean, I'd be curious if we could, like, load up a bunch of Euphoria teens in a movie theater and make them watch it, what they would think about this, because it is not something I feel like is entirely relatable to more modern sensibilities. But at the same time, I look at this and it doesn't feel dated to me, in the same way. The thoughts and feelings and things that the characters express in it feel dated. But the actual, like, I'm watching a modern film is what the feeling you get when you walk away from it.
Mm-hmm.
Even though it is, you know, celluloid, even though it is talking about film, even though there are landlines and nobody has a cell phone, yeah, like, it still feels modern in the way that it's made.
The stuff that Tyler Durden is spouting is a little too entry level and on the nose for today's modern gaslighting red pill people. They would try to be a little bit more circuitous in their route to convince you that to tear the world down.
I don't know about that. there's some stuff that I've seen where it's just like, that seems like clumsy, but you know, it seems to work on some people who I think are looking for those sorts of things to latch onto. It's disappointing that some people looked at this movie as something they could latch onto, the negative parts that they were not supposed to do that to. And but I feel the same way about American Psycho. Is that it's unfortunate that people can latch onto that as something that's like not they don't see the satire of like don't do this. This is not actually good. Like, this is not like, you don't quote this as a good thing. You don't quote Tyler Durden as a good thing. You don't quote Patrick Bateman as a good thing. Like, you need to understand that it is not intended to be taken that way. It is intended to be taken that way in the scene for those characters as you're moving through the film, and you as the audience are supposed to push back against that and understand the difference.
But looks right at the camera does. And talks mm-hmm. to the audience when he says, "You're not how much money you have in the bank. You know, you're not your effing khakis."
Yep.
We're all the same decaying organic matter. Like, that's deep, man, because it's true. The really think about it, it's true.
All singing, all dancing,
grab the world.
Yeah,
yeah,
yep.
We've been raised on movies and music to believe that one day we would grow up to be movie stars and rock gods or whatever it is that he says, and we're slowly learning that that's not true, and we're very mad about it.
Yeah, although in a modern era, we were all raised to learn that we could be influencers, and we're mad about it.
Tyler Durden in the era of Instagram would be hilarious.
Well, don't put it past, this is Fox that owns this, so I guess that would be Hulu. They could make a show, like a Hulu original. You could do a Fight Club, and it's all on Instagram.
I was scrolling through somewhere in here, and I forgot about it. I remember it at the time, and it was very upsetting when I learned about it. But there is a short story comic book sequel to this movie somewhere. I don't actually remember what it's about or if you even bothered to look it up. But it is also worth briefly mentioning that this movie is based on a book by, I don't know how to actually pronounce his name. I called him Chuck Palahniuk for my entire life, but Craig Mazin calls him Chuck Palahniuk, and I don't know how to actually pronounce his name. But I did read this book. Did you ever read the book?
No.
It's weird. A weird writer. He's a weird writer. I mean, I don't remember as much. I was very deep into loving the movie when I read the book, and I was like, oh, this is different. I didn't retain as much of the book as I did of the movie, but I do remember the ending of the book. And while we're talking about the ending,
I wasn't gonna let that pass.
Go ahead.
So the movie was finally released in China recently, although, you know, when you listen to this episode of the podcast, it may have been several weeks ago, but Chinese censors finally allowed it to be released with the change of the last scene being deleted and the text being replaced with a kind of, you know, at the end of an 80s movie where they just be like, yeah, this is what happens. They kind of did one of those. And it says, though the clue provided by Tyler, clue provided by Tyler, the police rapidly figured out the whole plan and arrested all criminals, successfully preventing the bomb from exploding. After the trial, Tyler was sent to a lunatic asylum, receiving psychological treatment. He was discharged from the hospital in 2012.
Yep.
Yeah, and so I don't think that makes anything any better, because you are... It steps on the the art of it, as flawed as it may be, or you may perceive it to be, in, I think, maybe one of the least objectionable parts of the film, which is the ending, to insert something where it's like, no, authority of the state is really what we're concerned with, and that is the only thing you need to take away from this editing process, is that
you're gonna try all this stuff, yeah, we're gonna bust you bad.
Yeah, and that doesn't necessarily make any sense. Also, I don't know why they would be concerned, because it is depicted as some, correct me if I'm wrong, but nameless sort of large city where they are, because it has qualities of Los Angeles and New York, because what they see blowing up is Century City, for sure, with the skyscrapers that are there, because you see the building that is Nakatomi Plaza in Die Hard, and you see the like triangular buildings that are like medical offices that blow up at the end, and they're in the Translite as well as the CG version, but it is not really described where it is that they are, and it's supposed to, I think, feel like any large city, kind of like how in the Matrix first three movies the Matrix city felt like any city, theoretically.
Yeah, I guess I never gave it too much thought. I always did just sort of think of it as modified LA, because I know that's kind of where it was.
Yeah, I mean, it's just nobody really lives downtown and does those things like New Yorkers do, like they depict at the beginning of the film.
Where did they build the house on Paper Street?
I don't know.
That's certain. Yeah, go look it up. But it wasn't on a backlot or anything. They just went and built that somewhere.
Yeah, and the airport scene where his luggage is impounded or destroyed because of the vibrator.
Yes.
A vibrator. That was in LAX, for sure, because that's what the baggage claim area looks like in those terminals. But I don't know what the intent was for, like, what the city is supposed to be, because they have the flight coupons that Edward Norton's character goes through at the end, and one of them is, you know, one of them's Dallas, one of them's Los Angeles, and it's like, well, you wouldn't fly from Los Angeles to Los Angeles, so I don't think he went that route specifically, but at the same time, it looks like Los Angeles, like 100%. That's Century City for the Translite and the explosions.
Yeah. I did find the address of where they built the house, just because I couldn't leave well enough alone. Where am I? I'm slowly zooming out.
So gross, by the way.
I am south of Carson.
Okay.
Near the water, Wilmington.
Oh, yeah, that's technically the city of Los Angeles.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's very close to the Wilmington Waterfront Park. Interesting.
Yeah, if you look at the map of Los Angeles, it's very interesting, because there's like a big blob and there's like a skinny little stick that goes down to where the port is. And that skinny little stick, part of it is Wilmington.
Oh, I see where I am now. Wow, they went all the way down there to build this piece of shit.
Well, I mean, I think that it's not just about the piece of shit, it's about the land.
Yeah.
Because they needed to have the sort of like industrialized area around it. Yeah, that house is gross. Yeah, mm-hmm, gross. Mm-hmm. Icky.
Very icky. Oh, no, just one more thing on the ending before I forget. The reason I brought up the book is that title card about being arrested, it's actually partially pulling some of the stuff from the book, which, can I spoil the end of the book for you? You're going to read it?
I will never read this book.
Okay. Well, he does the shooting himself thing, but at the end he thinks he's dead. And there's like this, you know, shortened chapter at the end there where he's sort of describing what it's like to be in heaven, 'cause he's dead now. But what he's describing is the fact that he's actually in an asylum. He's, you know, padded wall sort of hospital thing. And the book ends with basically like the janitor at the hospital sneaking in and going like, "Hey buddy, we're still doing Project Mayhem stuff. We'll break you out of here soon." So that's the way the book ends.
That's interesting. I wonder if that would have been more appealing than the direction that they went. Because I feel like there's also a lot of people who were just like, "Yeah, the Pixies," just because of this one song.
It's a great use of that song.
It's. I don't have a problem with it, but I feel like they're just there's sort of a flaw in, you know, people appreciating it in the context.
And people still, they still don't get it, even as the Pixies play and we're watching the camera slowly pull back of all these buildings explode and the filmmaker has the audacity to flash another penis in your face.
Oh, yeah. I saw the penis.
Well, not another. It's the same one as before.
Yeah. But the... and very bushy, too. But the...
the 90s.
So at the time. No, but the there's also another thing we should mention in terms of, like, current topics, because it's not just the ending of this that is in the news these days. Meatloaf, who played Bob, Robert Patterson, died.
Paulson.
Robert Paulson, sorry.
Yeah, his name is Robert Paulson.
Yeah, but only in death, because nobody understood that.
And like, his name was Meatloaf.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but unfortunately, he died. He's good in this film. I only really know of him from Rocky Horror Picture Show and this. I was not a fan of his music, but he was a colorful character in life and had a lot of political leanings that I very much disagree with. And one of those political leanings wound up with him not getting vaccinated and having complications from COVID-19 and dying. So it is kind of grim, really, when you think about it, for him being in the news these days with that. It's unfortunate. And it would have been better had, you know, speaking of people not understanding things and the messages around them and appeals to masculinity or, you know, personal authority or your own ability to dictate your future. Like, I, you know, there are some flaws to that where someone may consider themselves to be enough of an expert not to do something that would be medically sound for them. But, you know, he was 74. So at some point everybody goes, I guess, but I hope he enjoyed everything for his life for that point.
Yeah, we did not decide to do this movie because of his passing, but
no,
that also happened recently.
Yes. Yeah, mainly we just wanted to talk about David Fincher films in a row, and we just picked some highlights, and I would say that this is one of the highlights. So, you know, kudos to you for being in one of the highlights, Meatloaf. Also, cinematography. Jeff Cronenweth, who I like and who did Social Network 2. I am curious why he works with David Fincher infrequently instead of consistently. Because one of the things that I think about often is how much I would like Steven Spielberg to work with, like, literally anyone else other than the same cinematographer he's been using since the mid-90s.
Yeah, you know... it's funny, of the few things, like I said, I have a sort of photographic memory of some of the interviews and special features and things about this movie. One of the things I remember is the commentary, which I have not watched in at least 15, 20 years, is Brad Pitt and Edward Norton on the commentary with David Fincher making fun of him repeatedly for the first 20 minutes going like, why is this movie so dark? Did you, there's no lights. Like, what real dark movie, Fincher? What's the deal here? It's like, would you guys just shut up? Yeah. Like this movie is almost more negative space than it is lit scenery, which is you're watching this and it's like that real hard contrast lighting. It's like, yeah, this is a bit of a weird move, especially knowing the way he goes later in his career, especially with Cronenweth, where everything is sort of unlit, sort of no look, as he describes it, where everything is just kind of ambient and low the entire time. This is not that.
Well, I would say that I feel like Social Network is kind of an in-between between this and his... at least the bits and pieces I've seen of the later work. Because I haven't actually seen The Girl with Dragon Tattoo or Gone Girl. There are parts in Social Network where it feels, I would say, sourcey, where you're using sources on set to dictate a lot of the lighting. Because there's a lot of nighttime photography in that too, where they're on campus at night or in someone's room at night. And so you're relying on the practical lights that are around you, at least as motivation for the lighting that you're doing. And So it doesn't feel as like flatly ambient as the bits and pieces I've seen of the girl with the dragon tattoo or Gone Girl. But it's interesting because I would say that Fight Club does feel like Seven and like Alien 3, where there's this really high contrast look to everything that I don't feel like we see now as much, but I feel like it was a look that was consistent with the time in terms of his contemporaries, because it was a way to set yourself apart, I feel like, from the flashy stuff or like, you know, big kind of like flatly lit things that were going on. Because if you look at what's going on in terms of like the, you know, 1999, 2000s era, there's kind of a lot of flatly lit stuff. Like, when was the Sam Raimi Spider-Man? It's not like the super dynamic lighting that's going on there.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I really like the cinematography in this movie for as dark as it is. Like, you know, it's an interesting choice in addition to the fact that you realize how little you really need to see Brad Pitt and Ed Norton's face in, you know, some of these scenes to know who they are and to recognize their differences. And, you know, again, there's story points there too, where you're sort of, they're in the darkness, which one's which, they're the same person kind of stuff. But you know, the stuff they did out back, when they're first fighting behind Lou's tavern, where you've got that sort of like steam rising on the other side of the building, where you can tell there's like a giant 12K light or something, and they're just lit with these little fluorescents and stuff. Like, it's a cool looking thing. And it's a good looking movie.
Yeah. I appreciate the sort of like cool tungsten, like weird look of all of the stuff they did with the nighttime photography, like neon or whatever, like everything's got like kind of a greenish cyan, quality to it.
Remember when I took screen grabs from the movie and corrected the green back out of them on that Twitter thread to see what they would look like, and they were like, "Ooh, this is just boring now."
Well, I feel like there was a lot of interesting grading that was going on at the time. I feel like society now, unfortunately, has gone to a place that's less interesting with grading. But, you know, with film, I don't know if this was graded chemically or digitally. I assume it was graded chemically at the time.
Probably. I mean, when was Oh Brother, Where Art Thou?
It was around the same time period.
Oh brother, we're at 2000. Yeah, so I guess it was, I mean, but that one was supposed to be like the first major. I assume this was chemically as well. I mean, this is still squarely in the center of the magic of the cinematography process and film and, you know, all that magical Hollywood stuff and Panavision ruling the world.
Yeah, I don't know. So I like Cronenweth and his work, and I like The Social Network. I think The Social Network, for me, is a more beautiful movie in terms of lighting than this, but it's just because he had 11 years to change what he was doing from that one to the other one. But the effect of Fight Club, the look of it, is appropriate to the film that it is in too, which is important because it is supposed to be grimy and gritty and harsh. It is not supposed to be light and bright and fluffy. But there are moments where the film is supposed to be, it's supposed to like have fill light where it does, you know, like when they do the catalog shot of all the furniture being placed inside the IKEA catalog thing, when it's supposed to look like catalog photography. And so they are, it is not that they force, I think, the look on everything in a way that hurts the picture. They I think are very artful about what they're doing with the look of everything. And I like the camera moves in this. And I think a lot of time that gets left out of the conversation about the cinematography, when we're talking about it, is just like, there are a lot of times where, especially when you have the scenes with Marla and Edward Norton and Brad Pitt, where the camera is moving through the space to go from Edward Norton to Marla to Brad Pitt back to Edward Norton, back to Marla, et cetera. And you can kind of use the camera move as a way of showing that the space is broken up, or that things are non-contiguous, in a way that is impractical to do with, or would be weirder to do with cuts than it would be to do with the camera move the way it is. And so I appreciate that.
Yeah. One of the most valuable people on any of David Fincher's movie sets is the dolly grip and the camera operator, because he is historically very strict about the smoothness of his camera moves, even to the point that they are post-stabilized and smoothed even further, because that's the type of thing he wants to do. But
yeah, isn't that why he like shoots 6K these days? Is because not because he's actually delivering 6K, but because he wants to be able to stabilize and crop as much as he wants to.
Yeah, he wants to have like at least you know, 1,000 pixels around the edges that he can use to make sure that the character is smoothed and stabilized in the frame and exactly where he would like them to be. And like, if you see the unstabilized version of it, it's still basically perfect. There's like one or two shots in this one where I was watching, I'm like, I can see like 2% of stutteriness in the camera operator, where you can just see it's like it's not perfect with the background parallax, but it's so good that if you were just watching this, you're like, wow, we're just like seamlessly orbiting around Edward Norton here. It's so good. But
and there's also like things that are artifacts of the film process, where you got like gate weave in the master that I'm watching, at least.
One other thing, I mean, I don't want, again, before this devolves into just a, like, let's talk about how great it was when they made Fight Club and stuff. The sound design of this movie, not just the music, which the music does really sort of become part of the sound design at certain parts, because it's not really music in a lot of this parts. It's just weird sounds from the Dust Brothers. But I really, really liked the sound design. And this may also be another artifact of me wearing my big fancy headphones. You know, those weird sort of like, I don't know, what do you call them? Like those like train whistle noises that are like stretched out and detuned, that are like in a lot of the weird echoey scene transitions and stuff. The mood of this movie is reinforced so well by the sound design in this movie. And, you know, like I remember watching this many, many times. And the part where he's sort of recounting how his pilot light went out, and we're cutting back and forth between the apartment with the weird photogrammetry and then wherever he is when he's telling that story, the music changes based on the cut. It's like this weird soft piano. And then it, on the cut to his apartment, when we're looking at the flashbacks or the sort of imagination, it's this other like, you know, techno-y drum beat song. And they're cutting back and forth. And it's like, this is such a weird thing to do, but it's all so perfect in service of this like odd tone and feeling that they're creating with the cinematography and the story of it all. But I really like the sound design of this movie.
Yeah, I like you know, the Foley work, obviously, for capturing the sounds of people, I guess, punching like sides of beef or whatever it was that they did.
Yeah, actually, I don't know. I would be curious to know.
Yeah, there's a lot of Foley work for capturing. There is a tremendous amount of people punching other people, and it doesn't sound like I don't know if this is actually true or not, but a lot of times people would like use apples or something where you can get like the like crunch kind of sound from them, and it doesn't sound like that. It sounds meaty in a like completely repulsive way.
Is there a beef puncher here in the credits?
No, I don't know about that one. But there is also, to go back to what you said about the music in many of these cases just being sounds, when Tyler Durden and Edward Norton are fighting, which is really just Edward Norton fighting himself, in the garage of the building where the van with the explosives is parked, it goes to like a 2001 Space Odyssey place where there is the sort of like cacophonous, atonal, you know, discordant choral stuff that's happening, where it is an interesting choice for that, where it is. And that's what you hear with the monolith in 2001 A Space Odyssey. So yeah. I don't know if that was intentional or if that was just something that they just happen to decide would be a scene where they'd have something discordant because he's fighting himself, but it was an interesting choice. And the opening credits for this, we haven't talked about, but it is an interesting choice too for the time period and for the content of what the opening titles are, because it is very 1999, early 2000s in terms of what you're seeing visually and the music of it and the fonts that are selected and transitions and stuff. Like, it's very computery, which was, you know, a new thing that people could do with film titles at the time. It wasn't just like Pacific Titles has put text over films that dissolves on and off. Like, you have like letters exploding into like whatever those little sprite puffs are and stuff. And they have like the weird little like bars removed from like certain letters and things. And
yeah, they made their own font for this one.
Yeah. And you got the really harsh, like I would say almost like Chemical Brothers, but not because it's Dust Brothers, kind of techno music over it.
Right now in my head without even trying.
Yeah. And you go through a brain, which you then realize is Edward Norton's brain.
It's supposed to start in the fear center of the brain.
Oh, that was totally recognizable to me. I just must have missed the sign that said fear center of the brain.
Yeah, no, I just Googled to try and remember exactly which visual effects house did, and it was Digital Domain. But yeah, that was here in this Art of the Title article.
Yeah,
I guess I could put this in notes.
I think Digital Domain did everything in this, as far as I know. But they pull out of the, well, they were a real company back then, but they pull out of the like a pore in his skin on his nose, and there's all the sweat beads, and you pull out along the gun barrel up to finally see what's happening. It is an interesting choice because I don't like those kinds of camera moves, but it is it is a unique way to do the titles for this movie while also kind of exploring some of the themes of the movie in terms of, it's his brain chemistry that's really behind all of this anyways. So yeah, why not just have that be the opening titles?
See, again, that's another subtle, like, from the opening frame, we're inside this guy's brain and he's looking at all these synapses doing their thing. Like, it's all right there if we want to put the pieces together and understand what the movie is trying to say. But we didn't.
No. And in terms of other CG stuff, like you said, the photogrammetry, which... for people listening, basically you take a bunch of photos of a place and you can kind of reconstruct that place and project the photos that you've taken onto the surface of that thing.
Yeah. If you have enough angles of a thing, you can triangulate the shapes and turn them into 3D models. And since the pictures have texture and lighting on them already, you don't have to put lights and stuff there. You just put the pictures on there.
Yeah. And there's some flaws to this process, of course, because the lighting is baked in, you can't adjust the lighting very easily. You'd have to redo everything, repaint everything in order to remove the light that's there and get the surface qualities of things back.
You could use the model and then like retexture it or something on your own if you felt like it.
Right. But if you are just trying to move a camera around a space and you don't care about, you want to keep that lighting the same, then it is a way to do that. There are a variety of approaches.
It's funny when you describe it like that. It makes it sound so quick and easy to just like, oh, if you want to do a quick 3D model of a place, you just take a bunch of photos and assemble and move around.
No.
It's so not.
Well, this is what I'm going to get to, the negative part. In like the stuff that's in like the garage at the beginning of the film, as the camera's flying around talking about the explosives and stuff, you see parts of the photography of the neon lights that are behind the pillar in the garage that are projected onto the edge of the pillar because the lights glow over the edge of the pillar and nobody paint fixed that. So forever now, for the rest of time, unless David Fincher plans on doing a special edition of Fight Club, you're going to see that there is a little L-shaped white and blue line that is along the edge of one of the pillars as the camera is rotating around. And in the case of photogrammetry in this movie, they're also combining it with CG assets in terms of like, we're going to put the van in there and it's going to be a shaded thing, but it's also going to be shaded with the technology of 1999. So it's not going to look very convincing from every angle, but it is going to be right up against the photography that's been projected onto surfaces. So it can look a little extra phony because of that, because of those camera moves that are going on. And you get other things like the garbage in the trash can and stuff. That's not photogrammetry. That's they modeled and textured and did all that. It just doesn't look very good. And then you have like the penguin. That's not photogrammetry. They have a penguin that they made in CG and animated in the movie. Like, there's a variety of techniques at play here. But basically, anytime they try to do the camera move, extreme camera move, there's some element of photogrammetry in the background, at least, if not the foreground as well. But usually the textures break down in the foreground because nobody got close enough to the surface to be able to do that because a camera can't. So like the stovetop scene of it exploding, the gas on the pilot light being out, that is a completely shaded and textured and rendered asset in the midst of everything else because they can't get that close to the surface of the oven. And so it doesn't look very good or as convincing as the rest of the stuff around it. But there, you know, it's just, that's what it was in 1999. And it is kind of a bold choice to make the effort to do these things with visual effects, whether or not I agree with the choice to do it. Because in 1999, you'd reserve visual effects for robots and monsters and aliens and spaceships and, you know, things of that nature. Like, it was supposed to be for the supernatural or paranormal or something, like some super spectacular thing needed to be happened that could not possibly be filmed. But instead you have a situation where it's something that can't be filmed because of physics, but is a physically, you know, photographically real object, that an ordinary object, a stove that you just want to fly around with the camera.
Yeah, we want to push in behind the stove, behind the refrigerator to see the pilot or the compressor click on.
Yeah. So it's just a different approach to this. And I, of course, look forward to talking about it when we talk about Panic Room, as Dan alluded to earlier, because I love it.
A lot of Panic Room, there's a lot of practical cameras, then they just stuck a bunch of stuff in places too, and then they clean some of it up. Obviously, there's some extensions and things, obviously.
Yeah, love extensions. Mm-hmm. All right, so on that note, I think we're done.
Fight Club. Let's sing the theme song to Fight Club.
Fight Club.
We all love to fight at the Fight Club.
Fight Club.
Mm-hmm.